This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Fieldwork is a podcast hosted by two young farmers in the Midwest, focused on some of the innovative ways farmers are trying to make their farms sustainable. Today, we're joined by Mitchell Hora, farmer and co-host of the Fieldwork podcast. Hi, Mitchell.
How are we doing, guys?
And Annie Baxter, producer of the Fieldwork podcast. Annie, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Let's start out with you, Mitchell. Can you tell us about where you're from and what you do as a farmer?
You bet. Yeah, I'm a seventh generation farmer from southeast Iowa.
Seventh generation?
Seventh
generation. So that goes back over 100 years. Yep. Well over
100
years.
Just shy of 150. Yep. Just shy of 150 years of farming in the U.S., in Iowa. They were farming before my ancestors came and settled here too. So, so I need to look at how long it's actually been. But yeah, 7 years. So for us, you know, conservation and legacy is really, really important. So relatively small family farm, about 800 acres, mm-hmm. corn, soybeans, wheat, barley, and rye.
Okay.
So a variety of different stuff.
A lot of grain row crops.
We're working on some other things. Yeah, we're working on trying to diversify. Iowa is corn and soybeans. So yeah. To be able to integrate some of these other things is kind of cool. That's all coming from our work with cover crops.
Yeah.
So that's where trying to find some new things and some new opportunity to improve soil health and the resiliency of our farm.
So what are you looking into? What's coming down the pike potentially?
Well, so like with the barley, we're actually malting it for beer.
Ah, okay. Yeah. We talked
so
a little bit about beer before.
We talked about beer before. So yeah, we're working on trying to grow some barley for malting purposes. I have no idea if it's going to work, but I hope. That'd be pretty cool.
Is there any reason it wouldn't?
Overwintering is going to be the problem. So we got it planted. Right now, it's barely like an inch tall. It's really small. So we planted it after we harvested soybeans, drilled it in. It's like an inch tall, and I'm really worried that the cold weather over the winter will kill it. So it's kind of an experiment. We don't have that many acres of it, but hope that it can work and be something that we could scale, which would be awesome, and try to diversify our operation. The wheat and the rye we're raising for a cover crop seed. So just more cover crops, and we've tried a bunch of different things.
All right. So what is – I'm sorry. I have pork farmers in my family. I don't have any row crop farmers in my family. What does that mean?
Yeah. So a cover crop is a living crop that will kind of grow in your field when you don't have your cash crop out there. So it's a crop grown for soil health and sustainability and water quality purposes that's not being used to make money off of. Essentially, it's just a conservation tool.
I am – so fascinated with this, and I wish we could continue with Row Crops 101. But we are here to talk about Fieldwork, which is the podcast that you host. What is Fieldwork?
All right.
He's passing the buck.
Go ahead, Annie.
Fieldwork is a podcast for farmers by farmers.
It's not really just for farmers, is it?
Well, I suppose that's true. Although I will say, you know, so we spent a long time thinking about how we wanted to structure this podcast, and we had like a lot of meetings with farmers and people in the ag community, and what they really wanted was a public facing kind of podcast that would help explain what they're doing better to the public, because they feel very misunderstood. And I understand why that's the case. I mean, I covered food and agriculture at Marketplace as a reporter, and I mean, one thing I really came to understand was the trade-offs that farmers have to make and how hard it is to change their operations and, you know, and also kind of a little bit of the, you know, consumers want farmers to do things that are more environmental, but they're completely fine, you know, taking airplanes everywhere or buying a million cell phones or electronics or like, well, that stuff's made somewhere else where it's not going to have an environmental impact on us.
Right.
So I could understand where the farmers are feeling frustrated, but, you know, this is born out of an initiative focused specifically on water. And so we really wanted to do something that was going to be impactful on that front and really trying to socialize environmentalism among farmers was kind of the way we wanted to do this, and to not do it in a preachy way, to have farmers at the forefront of the conversation, talking about, you know, things that are not working, you know, ways that they've tried this stuff and it hasn't worked out, or why it's too expensive, or why, you know, expectations coming from, you name whatever major food company who wants them to kind of all march in step, why that's unrealistic if they if they don't have, like, you know, sufficient cost share or many other reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of the idea behind the podcast, is to provide that kind of medium for conversation. And we do have people who are non-farmers who listen, but it has always been unapologetically a kind of a play for a pretty niche audience, which is unusual for a major public radio station like American Public Media.
So. Yeah, because that's the thing. So the podcast is, you know, focused around sustainability and conservation, especially angled at water quality through the Water Main Initiative from American Public Media. But Zach and I are able to just have – so my co-host is Zach Johnson, the Minnesota millennial farmer. And he has not had a lot of success with no-till and cover crops and some of these conservation practices on his farm. He's up in west central Minnesota, very different climate than my area down in southeast Iowa. And so we're having a really cool conversation, I think, about here's what we've seen on our farm. Here's what these other farmers are doing and some of the challenges that they've seen, that – conservation and cover crops and sustainability all sounds fine and dandy, but the actual how do I logistically and economically do it at scale gets to be really tough.
You come from a family that's been doing it for over 150 years. Do you or your family, do you feel misunderstood? Are you part of that group?
Well, I think 100%. Yeah. I mean, so we're looking at like we are working to try to continue to do better. But one of the things that I stressed at the Field to Market conference that we're in Indianapolis for is the current structure for agriculture only rewards maximum yield. Maximum yields with as do it as cheap and efficient as you can. That's the only driver of profitability and success for the farm, is yield as many bushels as you possibly can, which means you got to use very advanced traits for seed. That's really expensive. And you got to use synthetic fertilizer and these tools that you got to make sure that you are maximizing those bushels that you've grown, because that's what you're making money on. And the prices aren't there. It's a commodity. You got to, it's an economy of scale. The margin is really tight, so you got to be able to scale up as much as you can. Well, now we're looking at, okay, if we want to do conservation, we want to do cover crops, we want to sequester carbon or improve water or improve nutrient density, that's all great and we can do that, but we're going to have to change the economic structure of agriculture to be able to create those farm-to-fork partnerships if we're going to be able to really do this.
Hmm. Annie, what's your role on field work? You're the producer.
She's in charge.
You tell him what to do.
She tells us what to do.
Handing Mitchell lines that he's supposed to read, and he's like, yeah, maybe I'll read.
She makes a script, and we don't follow it. She puts in all this work to like make a fancy script and like make it nice, and we don't hardly look at it.
Through that process, right. I mean, do you come from farming in any way? Do you have some sort of background of understanding for this? You covered ag for Marketplace, and you've covered ag before, but was this sort of a different realm for you almost?
Yeah, I mean, I guess a couple generations ago, we were. Farming family in Wisconsin.
Like
my mom's family, they were dairy farmers. There's still people there on that farm, and I think they have had such a hard go of it. They've actually switched to fish farming. And I don't remember if they're doing tilapia or catfish, but that's what I heard most recently. I really want to get out there and see what they're doing. But so there is that, you know, kind of background. But I don't know, just, you know, I've been in journalism for 20 years or something. And every time I did do a farming story, I was just so fascinated by it, and also really liked hanging out with farmers. Just found them, you know,
pretty awesome.
They're just really fun people, you know, at least the ones I've met. I mean, so much nicer than the talking heads that you have to sometimes talk to as a reporter. So when I became a reporter at Marketplace, I was the only person in the Midwest at the time, and I said I was going to be covering I don't remember even what the beat was, but I said, you know, I'm right here in the kind of like breadbasket of the country. Why don't you take advantage of my location? You know, I've got all these major food companies, General Mills, Cargill, tons of, you know, farming acres. I think it would make sense to build up a beat here based on, you know, food and ag. And so did that for a couple of years. And I really liked doing those stories. But that kind of teed me up nicely to then work on this project. And it also kind of sensitized me to some of the water pollution issues that come out of agriculture, because that's a really big thing.
So how then did you connect with Mitchell or Zach? How did this kind of all get going?
So I left Marketplace and, you know, just moved within the company to this water initiative. And we had another project going on that took us down to Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I heard Mitchell.
You're saying us and you're looking at him. So you knew each other before.
My boss, Amy Scotchels-Cole, who's the head of the initiative.
Gotcha.
So she and I went down to Iowa for an event that was tied to a different project. We heard Mitchell speak. And I was like, wow, that guy seems... He seems really smart. and he just was super personable. And I went up to talk to him afterwards and I was like, well, you know, we're kind of noodling with the podcast. And he was like, oh, well, I'm already doing a podcast and I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook and I'm on Instagram. And I was like, okay, he like is super, you know, media savvy and, you know, just sort of like a...
I'm everywhere. You know, but like was right there and like doing it.
Yeah, he was right there doing it.
So
yeah.
The idea of doing a podcast didn't really seem out of the realm of possibility for you.
No, so I had a podcast originally called the Topsoil Podcast that was with my local cover crop salesman. And we got the fancy bendy mics and we got like we were spending all
he
this time we were
mics.
interviewing people. Yeah, Zach and I always talk about the bendy mics. We spent all this money and we're doing it. We were doing a daily podcast.
Ugh.
Oh, yeah. Daily podcast about the stuff. We were meeting up. We were spending all this time. And when I was supposed to be running my company, he was supposed to be running his, we were spending all of our time dorking around doing a podcast that we were just spending money on. And we didn't have sponsors. We wouldn't get sponsors for a while. But we were spending all this time doing this. So when Andy saw me at this event, that I was on the panel for, I was like, oh, yeah, I got the podcast and all this stuff. And then a couple months later, they hit me up on like, hey, like, we're serious. Like, we actually are trying to get this podcast going. And I'm like, okay, I can help, but I don't know. I can't really take a lot of time because my thought process was my previous experience doing a podcast that took like all my time. And I was like, supposed to be my job and not dorking around doing a podcast.
Well, there is a podcast about everything, but how many of them are out there like this?
Right. So that's the thing. Like this, and the structure is totally different too. That we've only released one season so far. We're working on season two. Season one, I went up to Minnesota two different occasions, and we did 2 days of deep dive in the studio,
just like back-to-back recording sessions,
like long days of just interviewing people, recording, making a bunch of episodes. Then we released them weekly over time.
Yeah.
So it didn't take that much of our time to go into the studio. So it was no big deal.
We'll continue our conversation on modern farming next with Mitchell Hora and Annie Baxter of the Fieldwork Podcast. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Quick reminder, on our last show, we close out every week with the Friday Pitch-In, starting with a roundup of the biggest Indiana stories of the week. You can find that wherever you get podcasts. Back now to our pre-recorded conversation on sustainable farming with Mitchell Hora and Annie Baxter from American Public Media's Fieldwork Podcast.
We knew from market research that farmers are huge YouTube users. Mm. And you can imagine why, like they need to fix a piece of equipment or something. They go on YouTube and check it out. So they're actually kind of disproportionately high YouTube users.
And Mitchell, your co-host, Zach Johnson, also a farmer,
has
the YouTube channel.
Yeah. So Zach's a YouTuber. He's got over 300,000 subscribers and like at one point was well over 50 million views. I think now he's like way more than that. I think he's close to 60 million views.
And I think you mentioned his handle earlier.
The Minnesota Millennial Farmer.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what are his videos about? What is he talking about?
Just literally just daily life on the farm. And Zach just like videotaping himself of like, hey, here's what I'm doing today. I'm just farming.
But if you have 300,000 followers, there's got to be some actual compelling content there.
Yeah.
So what
he's
does he
very
do that's
funny.
Different?
He's
is that
funny.
It?
He's
the personality
it,
driven?
He hams it up quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah. But he also is really good at explaining, you know, the different things he has to do around the farm and the choices he's making. And he gets pretty technical, but, you know, his audience is different from ours. It's much more of a general audience. And he's got, you know, viewers from all over the world, even. I mean, he gets. Although, actually, you know, I've gotten several emails from people in Turkey who listen to our podcast, and Well, I guess there's farmers everywhere. Yeah.
So what has the reception been like among farmers, Annie? I mean, what have you heard? Positive feedback? What's coming in?
Yeah, no, it seems like it's filling a void that wasn't there. I mean, there are ag podcasts out there. There are sustainable ag podcasts out there. I think what we offer is, you know, again, just we're not greenwashing. And the guys have a really great rapport. So we really kind of... I always like start rolling tape on them before they start doing the interview because I want to get them goofing around and being silly and stuff. And I try to incorporate that into the podcast as much as possible.
Greenwashing. Explain what that means.
Well, I guess basically, you know, we really just didn't want to make it sound like it's all hearts and rainbows for farmers who adopt these practices. Like, again, being really realistic about, you know, the flops that they have in the initial years or... You know, how many years it would take to get something to work and how much harder it is to try these things now with crop prices, you know, being down versus a few years ago when crop prices were really high. And, you know, a lot of farmers, I mean, just even Rick Clark, the Indiana farmer we spoke with the other day, said that he had a lot of he had some slack in his operating budget. It wasn't as much of a risk for him to start making the changes at the time that he did because margins weren't so thin.
So reasonable environmentalism as opposed to this sort of fantastical ideal, I guess, of environmentalism.
Right.
What does it mean to socialize environmentalism?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, one thing we hear a lot from farmers is how really – the biggest barriers to change can come from their own social network. So whether it's the father on their farm who's like, "You're not, are you kidding me? Why would you do that? Like, you're not doing that on my acres." Or maybe it's their retailer who sells them their inputs, or their own agronomist who is not, you know,
they're just not familiar with it.
And so there's just a lot of pressure working against them, a lot of peer pressure, negative peer pressure. And so, you know, kind of like providing a space where there's more like role models, I guess you could say, of people who are trying to figure this out and you feel like you're part of a community. I mean, the analogy I use a lot, Mitchell's probably sick of hearing me say this, but like I listen to parenting podcasts. I have a 7-year-old and I know that the advice that's given is not going to be like, you know, every kid is different. Girls and boys are really different. But I feel like, okay, this is giving me an idea for what I can do. And I just feel a little less alone along the way. And so I think that's kind of what we are hoping to get. And when we did some focus group in the early going, that was one of the responses we heard. Just like, man, I'm out in the field by myself. I mean, farming is a pretty solitary operation. And so it's nice to, I mean, you know, you work in radio. audio just provides this intimacy where you have like a buddy, you know, like,
absolutely.
So now you have your little trusted buddy who's telling you how to make this work. And
well, but it's just having an open conversation about it too, where like there's, like we said, there's other ag podcasts, there's other sustainable ag podcasts, but a lot of them are just so god awful boring that you like can't even listen to it. Like I can't even make it through an episode, and this is like the stuff I like. But being able to have a real conversation, speak the truth, and like, hey, here's, we're actually doing this, we're actually trying to do these things on our own farm, but it's not all flowers and daisies. And but to open up, hey, there's other people here that are trying, that want to do something. But a lot of times right now, the guy who is putting his neck out there and trying something new, in a lot of these areas, they're kind of the weird, like, hippie farmer. That guys are like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing that? That's weird. That's different. Mm-hmm. Why are you being different? Where there's pockets. And I live in one of them where there's a lot of people that are doing cover crops. Mm-hmm. And those kind of hippie guys already paved the trail a long time ago. but they weren't necessarily the hippie farmers. They were like the big real-time farmers that like are really doing this. Like Rick Clark, 7,000 acres.
There's some truth to this. Yeah.
Yeah, like this is these are legit business guys. Like they're not doing this because they're trying to save the world from their little farm. This is like real big business farmers.
They're just trying to save their little farm.
They're trying to save their farm and trying to do the right thing.
And get out in front of regulations,
get out in front of market opportunities, and now we can just connect them through the commonality of the podcast.
How important is it for farmers to reach out to people like this through modern media formats
Huge.
Like podcasting, YouTube?
Podcast, Twitter is definitely the big one for farmers. So I interact with farmers on Twitter. That's definitely number one for me. Has been, you know, that's where you can really have an open conversation, I think. But YouTube, yeah, YouTube University is what a lot of farmers refer to it as.
Like, that's how I fix my car.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you YouTube it and you try to learn and learn from other people. Farmers are very visual. They're very hands-on. A lot of the people that really know about conservation ag and cover crops, they're pretty few and far between when we're talking about new stuff like this. Like, there's not a lot of people that really know how to do these new things. Mm-hmm. So you can be connected with those experts, though, through media, through social media, and we can amplify that voice with things like podcasts.
I think, you know, one of the interesting things for me is just a, you know, consumer, citizen, whatever, is that, you know, certainly from Mitchell, I hear like, man, then we just, the adoption rates of this stuff, we're not where they need to be. We need to have way more people making changes. But on the other hand, we're encountering so many farmers who are trying things. And so I'm like, it's actually way more people who are making an effort than I ever would have thought. Mm-hmm. And so for, I guess, the, you know, general public, who folks who are listening, I hope that they get that message, too, that, you know, that there are a lot of farmers who are at least trying,
yeah.
you know.
Because these are yeah. the people who are literally growing your food. Mm-hmm. And if they're misunderstood, then we need to listen to them and see what their world is like.
Right.
And that's what podcasts like yours get after.
Right.
And so let's get into some issues here. Mitchell, you talk a lot about conservation and sustainability mm-hmm. in farming. What does it mean to put these ideas into practice as a farmer right now in yeah. 2019?
Yeah. I mean, so we're looking at, okay, I can plant a cover crop is a big one that we've been doing. So reducing tillage, using cover crops.
You should explain what tillage means.
Yeah. So yeah. tillage, you know, where typically the common practice, like what my grandpa was doing, you know, is you harvest and then you go out there and you till that soil to break up that soil, incorporate the residue, incorporate the leftover, the leaves and the stalks of the plant and stuff. And you put them in the soil so that they break down. And then in the spring, you kind of have like a fluffy garden out there mm-hmm. to plant your crop into. Well, what we're learning is when you do tillage or you keep that soil open, it's a lot more susceptible to rain that's busting up the soil particles and carrying it away and causing issues like in Lake Erie or in our rivers. Cover crops and tillage and no-till are helping to make sure that we don't disturb that soil, that we're keeping it there, we're keeping it protected for the next year. But because of that, you don't have that residue incorporation. You have to change your planter. You have to change your fertility practices. You have to change your herbicide practices. You have to really fine-tune and listen and understand, hey, I'm not going to have that fluffy seed bed that's really smooth and consistent to plant into. So I need to make sure that I have my planter really fine-tuned, really advanced, so that it can handle that adversity in the soil. Until after a couple years, you can really see that soil is changing. It's adapting to this new type of system where it's a biological system that is recycling residue. It's recycling nutrients. It's becoming more resilient and sustainable on its own, but it can take a little while to get there. So we use data to help us to overcome that change and to fine-tune our fertility management, fine-tune the cover crops that we're using, how big those cover crops are getting, the types of cover crops that we're planting. There's a lot of moving pieces here. So using data, working with other people really helps us to make sure that we're making the right decisions, and now we're having a lot of success with it.
Yeah, because this isn't sustainability for sustainability's sake. You're doing this for your own benefit.
We're doing it. Well, it has to be. Like, that's one of the big points that I keep trying to make here is, like, farming is a business. And, like, yeah, it's a lifestyle, and farmers aren't in it for the money for the most part. They're in it because of the lifestyle and the legacy, and, like, they want that for their family.
And but
they
you need the
carry
money.
It on. But you have to, it's a business. You have bills to pay. You have a banker that says you got to pay your bills, and like you have to feed yourselves, and like you have to make money along the way. And we know how to make money. American farmers are probably the best in the world at farming corn and soybeans and some of these other commodities more reliably, safer, more sustainable than anybody in the world. But we do it in our certain manner that we're set up for. Maximize bushels that we're producing. with minimum, you know, with as efficiently as we can, so we can have cheap food. And in the U.S., we have like some of the lowest percentage of our dollar that's spent on food. Like, it's because of our ag system. Like, we're really good at it. Now you want me to do something that's totally different that I don't know how to do. My university people don't really like exactly know how to do it yet either. My local retailer, my local advisor, they don't really know either, because maybe there's a couple of people that are kind of doing it, but like they don't really have it all figured out yet. But we're hearing pressure that we got to be sustainable and we got to do this stuff and like we got to figure out this and we're going to have regulations. It's like, okay, that's fine, but like we got a lot to learn. And you're wanting me to do something totally different that the data is showing you typically have economic loss when you're trying these new things. Mm-hmm. Iowa State data shows $43 per acre loss when trying to incorporate cover crops. That was a survey that they put out in 2017. On our farm, we lost $100 an acre in our first year trying to use cover crops.
Wow.
Our total revenue per acre is like $850 an acre. We lost $100 an acre right off the top using cover crops. That's a bad deal. That is not a good way to be sustainable. If you're going to have sustainability, the farm has to be economically sustainable. And we've figured out how to do it. Now we're having success. But year one was a disaster. Mm. Now we're learning. Now we're doing it better and trying to scale that knowledge to other people.
Well, there are other, like, kind of, I don't know if simpler is the right way, but just even like
better fertility management.
Proper application of nitrogen using the right amount at the right time in the right place. And this is like, you might hear precision agriculture, you know, it's like, you know, these systems that help you figure out like where in your field you actually need more nitrogen versus less. And so then you're not doing a blanket application over all of it, which is, you know, potentially going to mean using way more than you need to.
That's a good point too, where it's like, I'm not the Iowa farmer that's coming to Indiana saying everybody needs to use cover crops. Like, that is a bad idea. Don't do that. Like, but I think everybody can continue to improve their impact on carbon, water quality, water use efficiency, and nutrient density. We can all continuously improve towards those kind of sustainable parameters. How you do it on your farm is different than how I do it on my farm. We might have some commonalities, but the specifics are very different. And different for even regions of Indiana or other places. So we can learn from each other. We can have that conversation, but you have to tweak it for your farm.
So is it common enough right now for farmers to be concerned about sustainability? I imagine it might change depending on where you live in the country.
Yeah, I think so. I think farmers realize, hey, we need to do things better. We're not naive to, yeah, there's problems in the Gulf of Mexico, and yeah, there's CO2 in the atmosphere. And like, okay, we see where we have been part of what's contributed to that. We're ready to be part of a solution. But like right now, the entire economic system is set up for the way that we've been doing things.
Right. Maybe explain a little bit about, you know, in terms of crop insurance. Yeah, so, and like what are some of the systematic ways that.
So like right now, I mean, the people who have widespread are like the ag retailers who are great at what they do, able to implement precision ag, able to help us to do things better and collect really good data. But a lot of them don't necessarily, we don't really know about, okay, how do I use a cover crop, or what about these new nutrient stabilizers or new specialty fertilizer products? Well, those are kind of different than what I'm used to. I don't really know how to help you out there. I'm used to, let's figure out how we can maximize our yield off of this piece of ground. Mm. You know, that's what they're used to. So being able to change that up is key. Part of like with the insurance piece of this is, you know, right now the federal crop insurance programs or other federal policies are very much set up. You know, their whole point is to mitigate risk, and they're looking at short-term risk is what they're looking at. Year to year, how do I make sure that we are mitigating risk? We're kind of keeping things the same, not really changing stuff up that much. We're going to play it safe. Well, doing some of the things that we're doing, which we haven't got into, like some of the we're doing some crazy stuff on our farm too, which is like way out of compliance with federal programs. So we are taking all the risk on ourselves in those things.
Dace basically doesn't, he will not have crop insurance coverage based like it doesn't on some recall. Of the stuff that he's trying out.
Like, which is like, we're not terminating the cover crop according to their specs, which is you have to terminate your cover crop early before your crop emerges. We're not.
Because they don't want anything to jeopardize that cash crop, right? So
it's risky to have that competition. And we're doing a variety of other things too that are like it's not in the book yet. So the policy kind of has to catch up on this and allow for innovation,
right,
to play forward.
So not yet.
Could be that
science will prove that what you're doing or what other people are doing that is considered a little more risky now.
Yeah.
Could be commonplace.
Oh, totally. And I think we're seeing soil health, sustainability, this whole message has accelerated incredibly quickly, way faster than what policy and universities can respond to be able to like do scientific protocols to like prove these things out. We're seeing consumer demand and companies, supply chain companies demanding this stuff way faster than where they are at currently. So I think that's causing a lot of confusion. It's causing a lot of uncertainty of what are we really trying to do here? We understand the basic principles of what we're trying to do, but a lot of the specifics are still kind of behind. But my thing overall with policy is allow innovation, allow people who are willing to stick their necks out and willing to try new things, try to help to support those guys, support people who want to try, want to collect good data, and want to spread a message to help other people. I think that's good to foster that innovation and not say, we got to kind of have you stay to the status quo or else we can't really help you out.
Mm. How much has modern technology changed the way that you can tackle some of these challenges?
Huge, yeah. Our planters are the fanciest piece of equipment that we have. That planter is making decisions like hundreds of times per second. It's crazy how fast some of these things are and like adjusting on the fly. It's pretty intense technology.
Up next, more high-tech solutions to help farmers make a living with sustainability in mind. I'm Matt Pelzer. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now with two people behind the Fieldwork podcast, Iowa farmer Mitchell Hora and producer Annie Baxter. So data collection and analysis, has that gotten easier and cheaper?
I don't know that's – well, I mean, it's getting like – I think it's going to get easier in terms of sensors.
Okay.
I do a ton of data collection to quantify soil health. It's pretty expensive compared to our traditional soil sampling that was very basic and now is kind of outdated. So we're going beyond that, working to create a bulk of data and aggregated data sets that does help to maximize the gains learned from that data collection. But there will be a lot more sensors utilized remote. So sensors that are actually collecting data from the crop or from the soil in real time, more data from satellites and drones and airplanes, more data from weather and other sensor technologies. That's really going to help us to learn at a large scale. And we'll utilize things like blockchain and machine learning and artificial intelligence to help us to scale that knowledge so that each individual farmer can have access to really critical next level data.
Yeah, I think it's important to remind people that we are still talking about farming. And yeah. We're supposed to be talking about a podcast. Yeah, sure.
Blockchain? Yeah.
But isn't it interesting how technological it gets, you know?
And I will say, you know, Mitchell is like he's really out in the kind of the vanguard of doing all this stuff. I mean, There are some farmers who don't even like really keep records of what's going on. They know what their yields are, but there's a lot of other kind of like data collection that they're not doing. So some of these ideas are a little bit like, I don't know if I really want to go down that road, and I'm worried about who's going to get my data. You know, we did a show, one of our episodes was dealing with that. And, you know, this conference that we went to here in Indianapolis, some of the farmers were saying like there's all these different platforms for data. Are we measuring the same thing? Is there a real standard here?
Right.
You know,
there's no consistency to
it. So I think, you know, we're people feel kind of overwhelmed. You know, I think it does help though that Mitchell's young. I mean, you know, both of our hosts are millennials. Mitchell's on the younger end and Zach is on the older end, but they have an appetite for experimentation that, you know, like we did a show where we had them interview their dads, and Zach's dad was saying like, you know, back when I was young, I would do, you know, test plots and stuff. And I just, you know, it's like you just hear the sigh in his voice. Like, it's just really hard to, like, have the gumption and the energy and, you know, to do all that stuff now. So I think it's really cool that there are people, you know, like Mitchell, who are, like, gung-ho and trying to bring more people on board and hopefully can make that learning curve a little bit, you know.
Well, just something steep. Into bite-sized pieces.
Mitchell, you come from many generations of farmers, and a lot of them have taken on the job from their parents, who took it from their parents. And what benefits come from that?
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, I wouldn't be able to be in farming if my dad and my parents weren't there being able to help out. Like, they're literally finishing up harvest right now at home. So they're out there doing it. So right now it's my grandpa, my mom and dad, and myself. My brother is involved a lot of time too. It's a multi-generational thing.
Everything's been handed down, and then
it gets handed down. You buy other land, you're renting other land. Like, there's a lot of moving pieces there.
And you have, but you have those people to help. Right?
You have those people to help.
Like, the labor is a huge issue.
The critical thing for me. So I was able to buy a 40-acre chunk on a beginning farmer program through the USDA. So I was able to purchase a 40-acre chunk here 2 years ago, right around the corner from the home farm. And when you have land come up for sale, that's like a once-in-a-lifetime kind of deal typically. Mm. So you kind of got to jump on it. It's super expensive. I made it out of college with no debt, so I went and bought a farm. So now I'm in debt for the rest of my life. when you have the opportunity, you got to kind of jump on it. But the only way I'm able to really make that work is because my dad has the equipment that's right there.
Right.
Because if I was going to buy, you know, $350,000 worth of ground plus $500,000 combine plus a $200,000 tractor plus a $150,000, you know, planter, like,
you get into seven figures before you know it.
Like, even higher than that. Like, it gets crazy.
Wow.
So you got to be
that,
really.
They don't have
careful.
That stuff on Amazon yet.
Yeah, no, it's not quite on that direct. Not on the 2-day shipping list on Amazon. So, can't buy a combine yet.
So you get a lot of knowledge and, of course, equipment usage and other things, other great benefits from your family. But on the flip side, there's got to be some tension between the generations. Like, what kind of an impact does that have, especially on efforts to change farming, like what you're doing, in ways that maybe older generations might not appreciate or fully understand?
So I've had success because my dynamic in that area is actually very different than a lot of other people. So when my dad came back from college, was the first year that they started no-tilling beans, 1986. They started using no-tilling soybeans. Mm. And that was very new, very different. My dad and uncle and grandpa bought what they claim anyway is the third ever no-till drill sold in Iowa. So the third farm in Iowa to ever have one of these no-till drills, like, that is very new. So he's used to being innovative and being kind of out on the leading edge there. And he did some speaking and stuff back in the day, like I'm doing now. So he's in a different situation where when I throw out a new idea that's wild and crazy to him, he like comes back to me. He keeps bugging me about new ideas and stuff that like he wants to carry on and go more. So I have to like pull back the reins on him, which is very different than like most of my other young guys that I consult with and people that I interact with.
His dad is a very positive person.
He's
so charming and full of energy.
He's gung-ho. So like our 800-acre farm, we have like 150 different trial things going on in our 800 acres. Mm. Like everything is a test plot. And in my little 40-acre chunk, I have like 75 different things going on in that little 40 acres.
Because I think that the caricature of a lot of farmers is just sort of conservative, not necessarily politically, but just sort of set in their ways. Like, this is what works. Let's keep doing this. We don't want to, you know, why mess with what we know works?
It's just the risk of change. Yeah. So the typical farmer has 35 to 40 seasons, 35 to 40 at-bats, really is what it is. You can't take a couple of them and mess them up. You don't have enough. So that's why they have to be really cautious, got to kind of stick to what they know. They got to kind of learn from other people. You know, you kind of learn at the coffee shop, which is synonymous with bar, and you learn, you know, and you learn from other people. And but he's willing to learn and be kind of a guinea pig for me. He likes it. That's obviously where I get my kind of curiosity from in this area. And he likes kind of seeing it come through. And he's just too curious for his own good, too, just like me, where we're willing to go and try something new. And I'm able to go and work with other private partnerships with input companies and different groups like the Iowa Soybean Association and Multicropping Iowa and some of these other groups that have found me a little bit of funding here and there to kind of help us with some data. So we've been able to do that, you know, work with some other odds and ends partners.
So farming is changing. Yeah. It's kind of always changing.
Always, yeah. It's always a moving target.
What about the consumers? How are they changing? It's been said a lot in recent years that consumers are generally more conscious than ever, especially in the way that their produce and food products come to them and are grown. Do you think that that's true?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that there's a lot of people think they know things that they don't actually know. Yeah. So, you know, phrases like
that.
Organic or non-GMO have come to like have these like halos for sustainability. And people don't realize nothing against those, you know, food that's produced in that way.
Yeah. But there's pros and cons.
There's pros and cons. You know, I mean, you know, if you want something that's organically produced, like, well, where are how far is it going to have to travel? What kind of carbon footprint is it going to have to get to you if it wasn't grown locally? You know, what Mitchell's trying to do in terms of the practices that improve soil health. Like, people aren't really thinking about the kinds of things that he's trying. They just have these, like, go-to mental buckets of, like, these are the things I've been told are important to look for. Mm-hmm. And I think probably need a lot more training on kind of the complexity of food systems.
And what excites me about data and about sustainable ag, regenerative ag, soil health, nutrient density, supply chain transparency fueled by blockchain is some of these labels have a great perception of quality. You know, it's marketing that there's some of these certain labels and different things that I'm buying and putting my food dollar on that it's more expensive and it's got these labels, so it must be better. It's got that perception of quality. What I like about data and blockchain is you're going to be able to see actual quantifiable data that shows you quality. Mm. And you're going to be able to put your food dollar behind that. And we're going to be able to do it cheaper than some of these other alternative ways of farming because of the way that we're managing and we're working with nature to farm more sustainably.
So, and we should maybe explain what is blockchain and how that applies to what you're doing in a commodity system. Where,
yeah. So with blockchain, you're going to be able to scan a barcode on a loaf of bread and know exactly where the wheat came from that produced that loaf of bread in real time. And you'll know all the practices about it. You'll know the organic matter. You know the carbon footprint. You'll know the water quality footprint. You'll know the nutrient density of that grain. You'll know the farmer. You'll see his YouTube channel. You'll see his Instagram and see his little kids running out there in the wheat field, like that kind of stuff in real time. That's pretty cool.
Which is not how the commodity system
right now.
Operates
it's all
now.
Right now. It's like, all just bulked together, and you don't know. Maybe this
stuff
is
stuff from his farm and stuff from that guy's farm, and that
it's all just
farm
thrown together.
All can get thrown together.
No matter how it's raised,
no matter we'll know where it came from, it gets mixed.
Yeah, it's all mixed together. Right. So now we have some technology to keep things segregated. But if we're going to do sustainability, or we're going to do farm to fork transparency, there has to be some value behind that. There has to be a reason to segregate grain or to create these new kind of supply chains. And that's where it's, what are those environmental impacts? So what is the actual quantifiable quality that makes it worth it to segregate this out and create a new value proposition?
From your perspective as a farmer, is there a specific issue that you wish consumers had a different perspective on right now, something that's misunderstood by a lot of people?
I think a lot of like just the misunderstanding there of pointing fingers at certain companies. Obviously, like Monsanto gets a ton of flack, and maybe rightfully so. I don't know. That's out of my wheelhouse. But everything that we do there, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So everything that we've done and some of the issues maybe that we've caused, I believe can be overcome. Mm. And I think what we've done is that we have influenced our soil and created a chemically driven system in our soils. And my view is that we treat our soils as a dead, static growing medium, and we utilize linear equations to manage that soil. Really, soil is a living, dynamic continuum, where in just one teaspoon of soil, there are more microbes than there are people on the earth. In one teaspoon of soil. Mm-hmm. That has a lot of power.
Yeah.
And we can actually work with those microbes and utilize more natural tools, utilize better products, better systems to work with that biology. We have some of the best soil in the world here in the I states and then, you know, in the Midwest. We need to be able to work with it. We
so
need
less
to be
about
able to
suppressing nature and more about like actually working within the natural system.
Work right? in the natural system yeah. that we know that it's a biologically driven system. So that's where we're creating complex algorithms to be able to help to actually factor that into our fertility management. Mm. We need to understand, okay, yeah, some of these things that we're adding into our soil that are registered bactericides and that are, you know, that are directly like their patent is to kill biology. That's probably not a good idea, but we can offset that though by directly really promoting biology. And we do that with cover crops and yeah. Okay. Some of the things that we're doing, we do for economic reasons. We do because they work and we're waiting for better solutions to come about. And we're trying to do as many good things as we can to offset some of the negative things that we do and overall have a net positive gain, net positive impact on environment and on human health.
What do you see as the biggest challenge to get more farmers to adopt sustainable policy?
It all boils down to money. That's the easiest thing.
I thought that's what you'd say.
It all boils down to being able to have dollars. And it's not – farmers aren't going into this. I don't think – farmers are not in this to become rich. They're in it for the lifestyle. They're in it because they love it and that legacy.
But it also has to be an income.
But you have to make money. So I think with all this – and I see it being in a couple different ways. Okay, so I see as far as funding for sustainable ag. Number one is a farmer is able to team up with brands and foundations and organizations to get some money up front as type of a cost share to say, okay, I'm going to really go and do something that's different, that is very invasive – or just very, very different. So help me to get some funding up front because we don't have capital right now. You've completely used up your operating note already and just trying to buy your basic stuff. So, okay, let's do some things up front. Have it very open and customizable farm by farm where I can say, okay, here's what I'm going to do over the next 5 years or 10 years. Help me to get some of that money up front. I'm going to put in terraces or I'm going to use cover crops or I'm going to use other water holding. A terrace helps to slow down water because I want to make sure that I'm holding on to that water in my soil and I'm not causing flooding. Well, to put in these terraces, that might cost me $40,000, $50,000 that I don't have. So, hey, help me to do that and I will offset the risk downstream for this city that floods all the time. Or for this insurance company that has to pay out all these insurance claims. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to fund it is get some money up front that's going to stop some of these other negative things from happening. Option number two is to be able to fund some of these desirable outcomes, carbon sequestered. And I can pay for tons of carbon that are stored in the soil. I can pay for actual quantifiable impact on water quality and the water that's leaving my farm. As I'm cleaning it up, hey, thank you, because now our water treatment facility – we're not spending as much money trying to clean the water. You're doing it for us. Mm. And for me as a farmer, that's great, but I gotta kind of learn how to do that. I might need some data. So, hey, help me to get some funding for that. So either like an initial, hey, here's what I'm going to do. Help me to fund this. Or a outcome-based, here's what I was able to do. Help to reward me for my efforts and my credits. I think it'll be a combination of those things where we're able to actually hedge against some of these mm-hmm, outcomes. Mm-hmm. But this is a different conversation that we can get way deep into. We're pretty into it. So,
Mitchell Hora is the co-host of the Fieldwork podcast. He's a farmer. Annie Baxter also joins us. She's the producer of the Fieldwork podcast. Annie, where can we find it?
www.fieldworktalk.org and pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. It is free. So people who are not used to podcasts, they should know. It's not going to cost them anything. It's really easy to find. Some people don't even know where the podcast app is on their phone, and but you get an Apple Podcast, Stitcher, and pretty
Let's
much everywhere
we can
you
ask
get your
Siri.
Podcast.
Can we ask Siri where?
That's a good question. Let's try it.
We might have to try that out. Siri should know where it is.
Annie and Mitchell, thank you so much for your time and your insight. The podcast is fascinating. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get podcasts. And be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Join us tomorrow when we'll talk about the 2019 Indiana Civic Health Index. Among other things, it found that Indiana has a lot to improve when it comes to voter participation. But there's some good news, too. We'll talk to one of the contributors to the report who recently founded a nonpartisan organization to increase Indiana's turnout for the 2020 election. That's tomorrow. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.